This is number 0030, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is indeed the Stuff File program number 0030. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File, we'll meet Leslie Ann Coles, founder and director of the Female Eye Film Festival in Toronto. They have helped many female directors get the recognition they deserve.
One notable film that really fell under the radar for a long time was a film by Deborah Kempmeyer, Virgin, starring Elizabeth Moss, who is now the star of Mad Men. The film came to us in 2003, and it wasn't getting picked up anywhere. She could not get it into a film festival. Robin Wright Penn executive produced it, and she co-starred in it, and we ran it. I mean, we featured it at one Best Feature Film at our film festival, and then it went on to win the John Malkovich Award, the Spirit Award in LA, for Best Feature Film Made Under $50,000. And a really great cinematography, great story, very edgy, somewhat controversial, like all of Deborah's films.
We'll also meet Kitty Martini, co-author of Thank You for Firing Me. What was the impetus for this book?
It was the only job I ever loved. I was in a huge ad agency. I had a nice office, a huge salary. It was very comfortable. And then the boss called me into her office, closed the door. I thought something was up. I go, uh-oh, she has a bulletproof vest on. Something's wrong. No, I'm just kidding about the bulletproof vest. But I knew the axe was coming down. And that's what spurred this book, because I realized that, wait a minute, it's not just me getting fired. A lot of people. Happening to almost everyone I know, or somebody knows me who got, you know, laid off, basically.
Plus, there's Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And we also have an idiot of the day, and lots and lots and lots of stuff. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0030, is voiceover artist Rob Reeford, who has his studios in Canada's Festival City, that would be Stratford, Ontario. You can check out his website for Reeford Communications at robreeford.com, and Reeford is spelled W-R-E-F-O-R-D, that's robreeford.com. Rob and I actually worked together many years ago, for many years, at the old radio station, and I thank you very much, Rob, for doing the opening slate on this edition, number 0030, of the Stuff File. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And we start off with the evils of texting on the road while driving. Actually, no, we're not going to start with that. What I want to talk about are things that are actually worse than texting while driving. And it's not that I'm condoning texting while driving, because that's a bad idea. That's a very bad idea. But everyone is so focused on that, that they're missing the big picture of some of the other idiotic things people do while they're behind the wheel. For instance, in London, England, 23-year-old Rachel Curtis has made the texting while driving problem seem harmless by comparison for what she was doing. She recently led police on a high-speed chase while she was busy injecting heroin into her arm at the same time. Police finally pulled her over, and she was ultimately sentenced to 1 year in prison. Now that is in London. That is incredibly stupid. But I'm not letting America off the hook, because, you know, in the United States and here in Canada, we are also focused on stopping people from texting while driving. But let's look at the bigger picture. People doing dumber things. I can find a story in the United States that tops that last one. Florida Highway Patrol troopers say a two-vehicle crash was caused by a 37-year-old woman driver by the name of Megan Mariah Barnes, who was shaving her bikini area while her ex-husband held onto the steering wheel from the passenger seat. Trooper Gary Dunnock said she was meeting her boyfriend in Key West and wanted to be ready for the visit. If that weren't enough, Barnes was not even supposed to be driving, as the day before the crash, she was convicted of DUI with a prior and driving with a suspended license. Barnes and her ex-husband, Charles Judy, slammed into the back of a 2006 Chevrolet pickup driven by David Schaff of Palm Bay. He and his passengers were treated for minor injuries. Barnes now faces a maximum of a year in jail if found guilty of violating her probation due to the wreck. Now, is it just me? Or did everyone else miss focusing on the real amazing part of this story here? This woman got her ex-husband to steer while she shaved her crotch because she was on her way to see her new boyfriend. What kind of an ex-husband is that? Really, what kind of an ex-husband? Wow. Wow. That's all I can say. Okay, let's travel to New Zealand for our next story. And by the way, let's say hi to our friends who listen to us on World FM, 88.5 FM in New Zealand. A New Zealand man is recovering from injuries after being run over by his wife twice. Sandy Telford ran over her husband, Terry, as she backed down the driveway of their rural property in the Hawke's Bay region, which is about 350 kilometers northeast of Wellington. Not realizing what she had done, Telford then drove her car forward, running him over again. Police said the woman was distraught and too upset to speak to them. "We are treating this as an accident," a police spokesman said. I wonder if her husband is treating this as an accident. Anyway, ambulance authorities said her husband suffered moderate head, chest, and back injuries, but was conscious and talking after the incident. Oh, yeah, he's going to be staying conscious, too. I don't think he's going to sleep one wink while he's around her. Okay, on to Germany for our next story. A German woman, fearful that a burglar was trying to break into her second-story apartment, called police after she heard someone climbing up her balcony shortly after midnight. Police discovered the burglar was a man carrying flowers and a bottle of wine who turned out to be the woman's boyfriend, but then he was arrested anyway for an outstanding warrant. "He was trying to surprise her with the flowers and a bottle of wine, but it all went wrong," said police spokesman Volker Koenig. He said the man jumped down from the balcony and tried to escape, but was quickly tackled by police. He nevertheless gave the police, who was taking him into jail, the bottle of wine as a gesture of thanks for the friendly treatment after the arrest, Koenig said. Ah, yes. Firm, but gentle. Firm, but gentle. You know, I was unaware of the fact that it was still possible in the United States to get arrested for what you think, but apparently it can happen. In Gastonia, North Carolina, 48-year-old Michael Francis McLaughlin is homeless and was arrested for allegedly holding up a sign reading, "I'm thinking of a cheeseburger." He did this near the interstate off-ramp. This apparently violates Gastonia City Ordinance 5-17, which makes it unlawful for anyone to beg or offer to work for money or other compensation by, quote, "accosting one another or forcing oneself upon the company of another," unquote. So Mr. McLaughlin was charged with unlawful solicitation under the city ordinance and was jailed since he couldn't come up with the $500 for bail money. Well, you know, what are the odds? The man can't afford a hamburger, so I'm guessing he can't afford bail. Now, let's think about this for a second. I'm assuming that since he didn't come up with bail, he was in jail for a while, so they would have had to have fed him. I wonder if he got his cheeseburger after all. I don't know. I think that story's a little incomplete. Moving right along, in Menifee Union School District in Southern California, they've gone to the trouble of removing all the copies of one particular book from its elementary school's shelves after parents complained that the book is totally inappropriate for youngsters. Was it Catcher on the Rye? No. Was it Lady Chatterley's Lover? No. Weird thing is, the controversial book in question is Merriam-Webster's 10th edition of the Dictionary. So, what's the problem? Apparently the parents were outraged that the dictionary contained a reference and definition of oral sex. Well, you know, my parents always taught me, if you're old enough to think about it and ask about it, you're old enough to look it up. That's all I'm saying. Okay, moving right along, a group of 100 sheriff's deputies were training at a sports center in Commerce, California, when a tagger stopped to graffiti the glass door leading to their conference room. It turns out we could see him, but he couldn't see us, said Captain Mike Parker, who happened to be the instructor. The tagger ran as about 40 deputies piled through the door to grab him, but Joshua Vasquez, age 22, tripped over his own feet and fell. The deputies apprehended him. The subject, by the way, of the training that the deputies were all there for? This is a quote from Parker. We were discussing the importance of having backup when engaged in foot pursuits. Well, point well taken now, I guess. And finally, in this section of the stuff file here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest, in Lancaster, California, one theatergoer was only expressing what we've all felt, shock at the rudeness of other people. Here he was at the Cinemark 22 Theater trying to catch a movie while a woman near him was just yapping away, yap, on her cell phone in the middle of the film. So he asked her to stop talking and turn off her phone, you know, like you're supposed to do. That's when the woman's boyfriend pulled out a meat thermometer and stabbed him in the neck. Because, you know, I never go anywhere without my trusty meat thermometer. The victim was hospitalized and is expected to survive. Two other people who attempted to help the victim were also injured in the altercation. Police are now looking for the stabber. Seriously, who brings a meat thermometer to the movie theater? Do you think a barbecue is going to break out in the middle of the film? I don't know. Luckily, those things don't happen at film festivals, where more civilized people watch movies. And that is a segue to our first guest. On the line with us right now is Leslie Ann Coles, who is the founder and director of the Female Eye Film Festival, which is going to be kicking off its 8th edition in Toronto. The festival dates are from March 24th to the 28th. Hi, Leslie. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing, Peter?
I'm fine. It's nice to have you back with us on the program. Another year has gone by, and with the Academy Awards, some pretty big news in who won Best Director this year.
Absolutely. We were all abuzz talking about it and what the, you know, what the implications were and what they would be. And I think one of the questions that sort of arose out of all of it was, you know, some of us were asking, you know, in order for a woman director to get a nod by the Academy to get nominated and or to win, does that mean we have to make war films? Or films where things blow up other than human emotions, you know? So that was sort of where we were all at. But congratulations to her, really, truly, hats off, great film, and we're thrilled.
Well, one of the things that caught my attention, which I just want to touch on briefly, is that there are so many, you know, ceilings, glass ceilings you have to break through. And I'm just wondering, has this broken another glass ceiling in that you don't have to be ghettoized? A woman doesn't have to make traditionally a woman's film.
Well, I think, you know, certainly Catherine's film, Terry Scoglin's film, The 150 Dead Men, Mary Harron, American Psycho. I mean, I can think of a number of films that come to the female eye annually that certainly help dispel the myth that women make, you know, fluffy romantic comedies. I mean, we write great comedies and great romantic comedies come out of female writer directors, but that's not what we do. And I don't think a woman, you know, goes into making a film saying, I'm making this for a female centric audience. I mean, they just make a film, right, and hope to attract a wide demographic and a wide audience. And certainly Catherine's film did that. Whether it will have, you know, big, you know, far-reaching implications on, you know, women directors, you know, who still have to fight harder, faster, stronger to get funding for their features. I don't know. I guess time will tell. It certainly put the magnifying glass on women directors and the plight of women directors, actually.
Absolutely. The Toronto International Film Festival played an important role in the Hurt Locker's success because no one wanted to touch that film before it premiered there. On another scale, your film festival, the Female Eye Film Festival, how important is that to women directors, especially now in its 8th year?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I can speak to a couple of films. You know, one notable film that really fell under the radar for a long time was a film by Deborah Kempmeyer, Virgin, starring Elizabeth Moss, who is now the star of Mad Men. And the film came to us in 2003. And it wasn't getting picked up anywhere. She could not get it into a film festival. And Robin Wright Penn executive produced it, and she co-starred in it. And we ran it. I mean, we featured it. It won Best Feature Film at our film festival. And then it went on to win the John Malkovich Award, the Spirit Award in LA, for Best Feature Film Made Under $50,000. And a really great cinematography, great story, very edgy, somewhat controversial, like all of Deborah's films. And then, you know, she came to us last year. We opened with her film Hound Dog, starring Dakota Fanning, again executive produced by Robin Wright Penn, co-starring Robin Wright Penn, who really should have, in my mind, at least received a nod for Best Actress in that film. She was absolutely brilliant. So was Dakota. And there was a lot of backlash. I don't know if you know, it broke out in Sundance, and there was a lot of backlash about that film. You know, people criticizing Deborah for sexualizing Dakota's character.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at it, and there was like a 2-hour Q&A following the screening of the film, which opened the festival last year, as I said. And no one saw that. You know, it was a little girl. We all identified with her. You know, she was coming of age, but we had to ask ourselves if a man had directed that film, would there have been the same controversy? So, you know, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think there are a lot of films that fall under the radar, and I think, you know, women's films still do get relegated to the chick flick category, and certainly hope that there are 35 known women's film festivals around the world. Perhaps someday there will not be a need for women's film festivals, but at this point, we still need them. We still need an exclusive showcase to celebrate films directed and written by women.
So what are you excited about this year at the Female Eye Film Festival, which takes place the 24th to the 28th?
Well, I'm really excited that we're opening with a great Canadian feature. Penelope Boutenhouse, it's her debut feature film, Awake. It is unbelievable. Really, truly, at the end credits, you'd be astonished to find out something that is revealed through the film. Great Canadian cast, so I'm really excited about that. We have a fabulous film by a newcomer to feature directing, Becky Smith, on Saturday night at 7 p.m., starring Haley Hirsch and Teresa Russell and a number of other notable upcoming stars in Hollywood. It's a great film, coming of age, about a young girl who's never been kissed and her quest for that on her 16th birthday. And then we have a great film, again by a debut feature director, Angelia Garcia Combs, also out of L.A., starring Karen Black, Barbara Bain, and Julia Garcia Combs, and it's a great story about a mother and daughter, and the mother who comes to live with the daughter, and the mother's bipolar, and it's hilarious. It's this bittersweet, very realistic portrait of a mother-daughter relationship under a very unusual circumstance, living with a very unusual sort of situation. And that is our closing feature. So we have some great closing features, and we have some staggering docs. Twilight, Love at the Twilight Motel, Allison Rose, who's a Toronto-based documentary filmmaker, Expansive Grounds, that came out of Germany. It's going to raise a few questions. And certainly, you know, all the great shorts that we have, and Guerrilla Midwife, oh my goodness, like there's so many of them. But really, really great films. And, you know, I'm pleased to say we're showing 52 films this year, so 52. That's a lot of film.
Yes, it is. What's it like for you putting this, being the founder and the director, putting this all together through the course of the year?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if you know, but I'm also a filmmaker,
yes,
actress, and I've been, you know, I'm in production with my own documentary feature, and so it's challenging in that, you know, it's, you know, I've got to get back on top of my film, and it just got picked up by, well, CBC have expressed an interest in licensing it once it's complete. So now I need to go after the rest of the funding to go, I got to travel overseas to shoot for 5 days. So it's great. I'm really enthusiastic about the Female Eye. I love her. I wouldn't have thought ever that I would be a festival director. It really started off as this, it started off as a question. In 2000, I was hitting film festivals with my debut 40-minute 16-millimeter film In the Refrigerator, and it was winning a lot of awards at the international film festivals, indie film festivals, and I noticed there weren't a lot of women attending these independent film festivals, and I asked myself, is this because there aren't many women directors, or is this because their films aren't getting programmed? And that question, you know, inspired me and a good friend of mine, Norma Hoy, to celebrate films directed by women at the Bloor Cinema, which is a great repertoire theater in Toronto, for a weekend. And I invite about 23 films that I had seen while I was hitting, you know, predominantly U.S.-based indie film festivals. And we ended up showing 42 films that weekend, and a lot were Toronto filmmakers, Canadian filmmakers, because we sort of conceived of the idea, and then we ran with the film festival, I think, 12 weeks later. So it was ambitious, and then we just, it's continued. So, if you know, it wasn't a plan that I had to, you know, it wasn't a plan. It wasn't like my life's vision to become a festival director by any stretch, but it happened, and it continues to happen, so I'm going to let it roll.
A lot of film festivals are also an opportunity for the business community and the film world to come together to see what's out there. Are you drawing attention from studios and distributors who say, let's take a look at this and see what we can find?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we get a lot of shorts, and we get films picked up all the time. We get very few films that come to us with distribution, with a distributor attached, although this year some of the features obviously have a distributor. You know, and we are actually, you know, and I'll put this out there, we're actually thinking of starting an arm of the Female Eye, which would be a distribution arm.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
That's
on the that's on the QT, baby. That's on the lowdown. We haven't publicly acknowledged that yet. But that's sort of in my mind because, you know, we polled our community of directors and we asked them, you know, would you be interested if the Female Eye was to establish distribution arm, would you be interested, whether it's a non-exclusive or an exclusive, you know, contract? And the response was overwhelming. It was like 92% of the people, of the directors we polled, said absolutely. So that's an indication that possibly their films aren't getting distributed. Mm.
Well, the festival is taking place March 24th to the 28th. For those in the Toronto area or coming to the Toronto area, where can people go to find the films? I'll mention the website right now, femaleeyefilmfestival.com, but where exactly will it physically take place in Toronto?
It will take place at the Rainbow Cinemas Market Square. That's down across from the St. Lawrence Market. And do you know what? I just completely drew a blank on the address. Hang on a second. This is not good. And that's at the Market Square Rainbow Cinemas.
Which is 80 Front Street East.
Oh, thank you. Yes, 80 Front Street East, and then at the Novotel. So the Novotel, you know, you asked me about industry. The Novotel is at 45 Esplanade. They're fantastic. They're supporting the film festival in a huge way. We have Creative Woman workshops coming in, Women in the Director's Chair moderating the Career Advancement Module. We have Catherine Hardwick as our honorary director this year, the original director of Twilight. She's coming in as our honorary director. We're paying tribute to a maverick again this year, Kit Redmond. We have the Director's Roundtable, where we're going to be actually talking about the glass ceiling and breaking through. And we have, oh, my gosh, script readings and director's panels and an intimate chat with Karen Black, Shirley Douglas, and hopefully Teresa Russell, if we can get her here, on the Saturday at 2 p.m. There's a whole bunch of things, from industry to script readings to, you know, workshops. PCI, Sony Camera are going to do a demonstration of the newest high-def 24p camera, so that'll be nice as well.
Excellent. And people can find out all the information on the website, which is femaleeyefilmfestival.com, the 8th annual Female Eye Film Festival, which is taking place March 26th. To the 24th, rather, to the 28th. And Leslie Ann Coles, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leslie Ann Coles, the founder and director of the Female Eye Film Festival in Toronto, which runs from March 24th to the 28th. Again, you can find all the information on their website at femaleeyefilmfestival.com. And, of course, you can find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. And stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0030. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the rains don't cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the rains don't cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the author of Thank You for Firing Me, plus Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America checking the pulse of the nation, and of course, an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff for you. We go to Newark, New Jersey. In the Newark area, six women who wanted fuller and more beautiful bottoms ended up in the hospital after receiving buttocks enhancement injections containing the same material contractors use to caulk bathrooms and bathtubs. The injections were administered by unlicensed providers and, of course, went horribly wrong. All of the women had to undergo surgery and be put on antibiotics. Different from medical-grade silicone, the substance used in the botched procedures was believed to be the diluted version of the non-medical-grade silicone. Fortunately, all of the women are expected to recover, and police are looking for the people who administered the illegal procedures. A police spokesperson said that this is a clear case of buyer beware. If it seems too cheap to be true, there's probably a reason. Okay, on to England. In England, 7-year-old Taylor Dawn has been suffering from headaches and nausea for over 2 years. Doctors finally figured out the cause. The opticians at Specsavers had mixed up her left and right prescription lenses on her glasses. A routine eye inspection revealed the blunder, and boy, did Specsavers really step up for this one. Store director Raj Shah apologized and then offered Tyla a complimentary $5 bottle of lens cleaner as compensation for her pain and suffering. Oh, the generosity just overflows, doesn't it? But the best part is he had the nerve to say to reporters, "We take customer care extremely seriously." Really? You do? Specsavers in London. Nice going, guys. Nice going. I'm guessing there won't be a sponsor on this show. Just going out on a limb. That's all I'm saying. Elsewhere, a group of 8 young women in Ganzhou, China, went to extreme measures to try to find a husband. All 8 said they were coming under intense pressure from their families to settle down before it was, quote, too late. So they braved the cold weather and stripped down to their bras and panties outside a subway station and danced for passers-by. The girls handed out sheets of paper with their personal details and the kind of men they hoped to marry. Many held signs that read, "Marry me," and "Time flies, let's date." Calling themselves the Crazy Beauties, the women said they had deliberately timed the event to coincide with International Women's Day. The show attracted hundreds of people, with many onlookers applauding and taking their pictures with mobile phones. You know, it's never good to appear too desperate. That's all I'm saying. On to Fort Lauderdale. Police in Florida say a man who was angry about the size of his water bills found a way to stop the bills entirely. He blew up his mobile home. Investigators quoted witnesses as saying Johnny Dossi, age 43, coated his Fort Lauderdale mobile home with gasoline, and the residence exploded only moments after he ignited it. Fort Lauderdale Fire Rescue spokesperson Matt Little said firefighters arrived at about 12:30 p.m. and found the house engulfed in flames. He said Dossi's home was destroyed, but no neighbor's structures were damaged. Dossi was arrested and charged with arson of the structure. Police said he may have been intoxicated at the time of the incident. Quel surprise. Neighbor Luis Alvarez, age 43, says Dossi was arguing with his father about the size of a $70 water bill prior to setting fire to the home. "I guess he got fed up with it," Alvarez said, "and that's the only way he saw out of it." Okay, I'm assuming that they put the fire out with water. Perhaps they should send him that bill, too. Just a thought. Just a thought. Okay, hookers in Lugano, Switzerland are being trained how to use defibrillators after heart attacks killed several elderly men as they were utilizing their services. There are 38 brothels in Lugano, with more planned to handle the influx of Italian men traveling over the border to visit. Modern defibrillators are becoming increasingly quick and easy for the layperson to use, said the British Heart Foundation. That was an interesting choice of words in that sentence, don't you think? One brothel owner said the machines are necessary since having customers die on us isn't exactly good publicity. And when she says die on us, I'm thinking she means that literally. Anyway, moving right along, in January, the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division posted a job announcement supposedly in line with current affirmative action policy. The division is seeking experienced attorneys and was encouraging qualified applicants with targeted disabilities to apply. Legally protected targeted disabilities include the traditional, such as blindness, and also mental retardation. That's what you want. A mentally retarded lawyer. Maybe this is a case of too much diversity. That's just a thought. And that leads to our next guest, since we're talking about jobs. On the line with us right now is Kitty Martini. She, along with Candace Reed, is the co-author of Thank You for Firing Me, How to Catch the Next Wave of Success After You Lose Your Job. Thanks for being on with us, Kitty. It's an interesting title for a book. What was the impetus for writing it? I understand that you got fired from a job that you really loved.
Yeah, it was the only job I ever loved, because it was a cool, it was in a huge ad agency, and it looked like a firehouse with a pole you slide down and everything. Anyway, but I had a nice office, a huge salary, and it was very comfortable. And then the boss called me into her office, closed the door. I thought something was up. I go, uh-oh, she has a bulletproof vest on. Something's wrong. No, I'm just kidding about the bulletproof vest, but I knew the axe was coming down. And that's what spurred this book. Because I realized that, wait a minute, it's not just me getting fired, a lot of people. This is happening to almost everyone I know. Or somebody knows somebody who got, you know, laid off, basically.
Now, was there any hint at all that this was coming beforehand?
I didn't know. It was a shock. When I got canned from that job, I had no idea it was coming. Just when I saw her close the door, I thought, oh, what's happening here? And she just said, well, pack your things.
Now, admittedly, you have this book, Thank You for Firing Me. But when you look at your background, I mean, you're a writer, an entrepreneur, a stand-up comedian. You worked at an ad agency. Just the background and nature of what you've done in the past and what you're currently doing, doesn't it make it a little easier for someone like yourself to bounce back?
Yeah, and that's why I wrote the book, because I'm really good at that, at bouncing around and just, you know, hustling and surviving without an income. So, I've been a writer for 20 years, and I've had, you know, staff writer jobs. I've written for magazines, freelance, and also staff. 9 to 5, you know, in the office. But I've been on both sides of the fence. So, and then I've been without money and living in my car. So I share all these survival tools with everybody who reads the book. Thank you for firing me.
So when you were fired from that ad agency job that you really loved, was it an initial shock? Was it initial fear? Or did it roll off your back saying, okay, I got fired, time to pick myself up and move on?
Oh, yeah, I was freaked out. I initially was really shocked because I had, I had built up this lifestyle. You know, I had a big car, SUV. I had a nice house. I had two kids about to go into college, and I set up a lifestyle that required, the kind of salary I was making at this ad agency. So to realize, like, oh, that salary is not here anymore, and unless I get one right away to match up with it, I'm going to have to be doing some drastically different things with my life. And I didn't think of writing the book until after I went through all the 5 stages of grief, which we recommend you go through. You know, you sit and cry, and then you get mad, and then you get sad, and then you start to accept it, like, okay, I have to change my life now, my lifestyle.
Okay, so you mentioned the lifestyle that you had and that if you didn't find a job right away, you'd have to rethink that lifestyle. So how does one avoid or should one avoid the quote-unquote rebound job?
Well, a rebound job is kind of, I compare it to a rebound relationship. When you get you first get divorced or you break up, well, you know, you're in a highly volatile state. You are desperate, you are needy, you're upset. And a rebound job is kind of that way. You're coming from desperation and opportunism. You're not coming from your true self of, do I really love this? Am I really going to love this work? Is it really me? Is it really something that I can develop into a good lifestyle? So we want people to not look at one thing and that's just get the job. Just get in touch with yourself, and then the money will follow, and then the life and the money will follow, even though things look bad, even though it looks like there's a shakedown happening and worldwide, and, you know, what, unemployment rate going from 7 to 20% in some places, I hear. So, even though, you know, those statistics are out there, you can still earn a really good living doing what you really love.
So, besides going through, letting yourself go through the five stages of grief, what's the first thing one should do after being fired?
You know, just cry or throw things. Yeah, some people cry. Some people just want to start right away with throwing things. I have a book tour called Thank You for Firing Me comedy show where we have people throwing marshmallows. We have a guy dressed up like the boss, and he stands on stage, you know, just yelling, "You're fired," and everybody throws marshmallows at him. It's very cathartic. So, but you could throw anything you want as long as you're not throwing something at somebody's head, you know, like getting arrested. But, yeah, just vent, basically. Get it all out, vent, clear your head, and then the first half of the book is called Soul Searching. And then the second half of the book is called Job Searching. So the first half of the book, it really, like, it stays with you. It's like your companion to all the process you're going through while you're clearing your head and really just connecting with, okay, what did I always really want to do? What do I really want to do now? Who am I? What am I great at? And then what's my passion? So that's kind of like the whole, you know, process.
Again, going through your experience and going and getting fired from the job that you loved and all the things you've done since then, could you go back to working for someone, or is that day passed for you?
Quite honestly, that day has passed. I don't work for anybody anymore now. I just work for myself. But, you know, if people feel better working for other people, there's a whole new industry arising out of the changing world. One of the hottest new up-and-coming industries is energy and the green, you know, just the green industry, they call it, green collar. But there's a whole chapter in the book about that, all the hot new industries that are coming up where you can just transfer your skills to that industry and make a really good living because it's new. It's something that has not... the best thing is, can I give you an example?
Yeah.
Like, my sister's husband was worked for an oil company as a diver, and he got downsized. So he went back to school studying engineering, and it's a whole new field of the platforms where they drill oil, where they're going to be turning them into wind turbines, offshore wind turbines.
Wow.
We've never had offshore wind turbines before, just oil drills. But the world is the face of energy is going to be changing in the next 10 years, and there's got to be people and they have to transfer their skills to a whole different lines of work. But so there's so many schools popping up now and new things to do that you can actually re-educate yourself. And in the book, we tell you how to rebrand yourself too. That's just one example.
It's clear by the title who your book is geared toward, title being Thank You for Firing Me. Is this a book that people who are currently gainfully employed should also read?
I think so, because you want to... actually, it's a funny book. It's not a stuffy thing. We joke a lot in there, but we have a lot of solid tools, websites you can go to, and useful things. But you always want to have an insurance policy. It's like an insurance policy because it shows you how to make money just out of your own house. You know, you can actually set yourself up as a remote employee for any company around the world, and they pay you by the minute. Some of them just pay you by the minute to be answering the phone for them. I mean, you know, you could actually run a, you can actually have be an employee working for another company remotely, or, you know, you can just answer the phone for them. I don't know if you've ever called like a credit card customer service line. Chances are the person that answered that phone is sitting in their living room in their pajamas. You know, saying, hi, you know.
Thanks for the visual.
Card, how can I help you?
Thanks
virtual assistant.
Thanks for the visual. We should mention that you also have a website, too, which is thankyouforfiringme.org, correct?
Yeah, and I have another one, thankyouforfiringme.com, which the word four is the number four.
Okay.
So thank you, the number four, firingme.com.
And what will people find at the site?
Well, the one that .org is fun. We've got all kinds of interviews with the authors, myself and Candace Reed. And you can order the book as well on that website. And then thankyouforfiringme.com is more slanted toward me. And I do personal appearances now. I go to colleges and organizations and teach people excerpts from the book. But I do it in a funny way with lots of jokes and entertainment.
Excellent.
So they're not going to fall asleep in their chair.
The book is called Thank You for Firing Me, How to Catch the Next Wave of Success After You Lose Your Job. It's written by Kitty Martini and Candace Reed. And Kitty, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Great. Well, it's great to talk to you again, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Kitty Martini, co-author of Thank You for Firing Me, How to Catch the Next Wave of Success After Losing Your Job. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. And go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0030. And you'll find links to Kitty's website, plus links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
Guest, Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side of the moon.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
Gosh darn it, golly willikers, gee, I'm having a heck of a good time. I'm feeling great, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing okay. It sounds like you're on the road.
I am. How do you know that?
It just sounds that way. Where are you?
I'm having to be driving. I'm near California, Missouri, which is not to be confused with Missouri, California, which is another town altogether. No, I don't even know if there is one. Yeah, I'm in California, Missouri. Have to drop in and see somebody. So I pulled over. I want people to know I am not talking and driving at the same time. I have pulled over. I have pulled over to the side of the road, and I am at rest right now. I'm just relaxing, and I'm talking to my good friend Peter in Montreal, Canada.
Well, there you go. Yeah, safe driving, always, always.
Oh, I know. I've got my safe driving card. I'm telling you.
Excellent. So what do you have for us this week?
Well, let's see what we have. I like doing that. Dateline, Lake County, Illinois.
That would be the land of Lincoln.
No kidding. 19-year-old Travis Copeland was in court in Lake County when he saw an opportunity to escape. That's what the sheriff's deputies are saying anyway. This guy was facing a charge of aggravated battery on a police officer. Copeland ran out of the felony courtroom with the bailiffs in hot pursuit. Anyway, as he ran through a skyway over a street, he saw that deputies were closing in on him from both ends. So he turned around and he tried to dive through the glass. And that was a bad idea. The glass, first of all, was bulletproof, so he bounced right off the glass. Had he made it, though, he would have fallen 30 feet to the heavy traffic of the street below. Hmm. You know, these criminals are not exactly the brightest people in the world, are they?
Well, what you're saying is the glass was bulletproof and idiot-proof, too.
Clearly it was, and this guy had a terrible headache, apparently. Dateline, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
That would be the Gopher State.
Or land of 10,000 lakes, if you prefer.
Yep.
You know, Peter, even the zombies are entitled to their day in court. An appeals court in Minneapolis has allowed a group of zombies, well, not really zombies, what they are, protesters costumed as zombies, to press ahead with their lawsuit against police who arrested them for disorderly conduct. The appeals court overturned a lower court in finding that the group of seven zombies had been wrongfully detained during a 2006 shopping mall protest against consumerism. The three-judge panel, by a 2-1 vote, ruled the Minneapolis police lacked probable cause to arrest the demonstrators for disorderly conduct. At the time of the protest, the plaintiffs were wearing makeup that gave them a living dead look. You know, white face powder, fake blood, black circles around their eyes. Some in my home state of Missouri call them Obama voters, but I digress. They, humor there. That'll appeal to certain people, I'm sure. Some in my home state of Missouri, as I mentioned, they call them Obama supporters. No reaction. Okay, we'll just move on here. Anyway, they lurched stiff-legged through the halls of the mall, urging shoppers to get your brains here, get your brains here, and brain cleanup in aisle 5, brain cleanup in aisle 5. In various bags, the protesters carried audio equipment, including loudspeakers and wireless phone handsets, and the police described these as simulated weapons of mass destruction. Now, an objectively reasonable person wouldn't think probable cause exists under the Minnesota Disorderly Conduct Statute to arrest a group of peaceful people for engaging in artistic protest by playing music, broadcasting statements, and dressing as zombies. And that is what the court ruled. So the court rules what how a lot of people would think.
Hmm.
Yes, yes. Dateline, Salisbury, Maryland.
That would be the old line state.
I used to live there, you know.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah, yeah, it was in a lot of places. This past winter was a bad one in part of the U.S. In Salisbury, Maryland, Aaron and Jeremiah Parkhurst had been in a heated argument when she got fed up and decided to drive to her father's house. Aaron reportedly got into the car when Jeremiah lay on the ground to try to stop her. She claimed she didn't know he was there and just thought her car was stuck in the snow when she tried to move it and couldn't move it. She finally stopped gunning the engine, and then she went inside to get help. When she returned to her car, Jeremiah was discovered under her vehicle. To further complicate the situation, the sheriff's office says, you'll like this one, Peter, alcohol was a contributing factor. You think? Anyway, so Mrs. Parkhurst is being charged with involuntary manslaughter, homicide by the motor vehicle, by motor vehicle, which is a terrible offense, apparently. It's a lot more serious than one might think. You're not allowed to use your car to run down people. Go figure.
Apparently.
Anyway, she was intoxicated at the time, apparently, and, you know, I tell you, the winter really was a bad one, wasn't it?
What I'd like to know is was Jeremiah intoxicated at the time? Because anybody who thinks stopping a car is easily done by just simply lying in front of it can't be too bright himself.
Peter, they live in Maryland.
Okay.
Dateline, Defiance, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio. I can hardly wait to say goodbye, oh.
Ah, yes, the Buckeye State.
Yeah, yeah, I used to live there, you know.
I remember.
Yeah, yeah. An Ohio fire department says the smell of decaying radishes. Radishes, that's right, they smell. Anyway, the smell of decaying radishes prompted calls from residents worried about a possible gas leak. Tiffin Township Volunteer Fire Department near Defiance in northwestern Ohio responded to 5 reports of suspicious smells in the last 45 days. A field of oilseed radishes planted as a cover crop that adds nutrients to the field is near a natural gas compression station and a gas exchange station. Tiffin Township's fire department chief, by the way, says each run to investigate the odor takes about an hour. Because you got to investigate, you know. Anyway, the agency responds to calls even when it suspects the smell is from the radishes. So whatever it is they're smelling, it ain't gas. But radishes, apparently, they can smell like gas.
Well, there you go.
Did you know that?
I don't know. I don't keep radishes in my house, and nothing I have here works with gas. So I'm safe all the way around.
Okay, I'm not even going to go there. I was going to make a gas joke, but I won't. Dateline, Covington, Ohio.
Oh, no.
There's that song again. Still the Buckeye State.
Yeah. Yeah, still I used to live there. That's a year of my life I'll never get back.
I remember.
Yeah. A woman was stabbed by a man waving a wooden sword. Worse, the assailant was admittedly drunk and on drugs at the time. Even worse, the suspect is a psychiatrist and the victim was a patient. The suspect is Dr. Douglas Rank, who now faces an assault charge after neighbors say they caught him attacking the woman with a sword. And sadly, Dr. Rank has had run-ins with the law before. He admittedly had sex with one patient and got into more trouble for allegedly prescribing the wrong medication to another. But police say what happened in this latest episode was a surprise to everybody. A police spokesman says he has some inner demons, apparently, that he needs to be working with, and now he'll get the help that he needs. The victim was taken to a hospital with non-life-threatening injuries.
You know, I
got to tell you,
I'd actually heard about this story, Steve.
You did?
Yeah, yeah. And there's something that's interesting about this story.
What would that be?
There's actually a follow-up to it, which kind of shows you how, it kind of shows you how delusional this guy's patients were.
Yeah.
Because even though he himself is locked up at this very moment.
Yes, yes.
His patients still want to have their sessions with him.
Oh, this is not healthy.
No, this is not healthy at all.
No, this is not good.
I tell you, if I were the relatives of these patients who still want to go see this doctor, I'd be pretty steamed. I'd be pretty mad.
Well, I'd be angry too. And you know, interesting, people do strange things when they get angry. You
yes.
know what I do?
Oh, I'm fully aware.
I take keyboard in hand and I write a 2-minute tirade.
Yes, yes, I know, yes.
And I've written one and I'd like to deliver it right now, if I may.
Tirade away.
Okay, Peter, how do I put this? Where do we begin? This time out, I want to talk about political correctness. Now, anybody who's heard this segment on your show is well aware that I detest political correctness in all its shapes and forms. But listen up anyway. There is something strange going on in the state of Washington, on the West Coast. Yes, it's the left coast, so we should expect a certain amount of silliness and stupidity, but this goes a little far even for the left coast. A state senator by the name of Rosa Franklin, she thinks negative labels hurt kids' chances for success. So she has sponsored a bill to change the wording of not one, not two, but 54 state laws that describe poor children, the disadvantaged, and those who are at risk to something she thinks is more positive. She wants to call these kids at-home. At-home kids, can you imagine that? Or some other such silly nonsense. Once again, we're seeing a member of a state legislature, a member who just happens to be liberal, which should come as no surprise to anybody, putting symbolism above substance. Instead of curing a problem, she's more interested in giving the problem a PC name. This is one of the many things that's wrong with America today. The time is coming, my friends, when we here in the United States have to fight back against efforts to change the time-honored names, give them things, and to call things what they are. Let's call a spade a spade. But you get my drift. Anyway, there's no place for political correctness in problem solving, because no problems are solved. By the way, an opposing lawmaker in the state of Washington noted that it would cost $3,500 just to print the bill to change the existing language. Just asking, but if we really want to help poor children, wouldn't that money be better spent helping, dare I say it, the poor children?
You know, I'd have a name for Rosa Franklin, but I don't want to get Sarah Palin upset. So on that note, sir, I'd just simply say, say those three magic words.
You mean, hit the theme!
This is The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have time for an idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Within an hour of bailing out on burglary charges, Andrew Bodden, age 36, was out committing burglaries again, ripping off cars, houses, and a church, according to police in Bendigo, Victoria, Australia. How did they know? Investigators say they found Bodden's police charge sheet at one crime scene where he dropped it. At another break-in, they found a DVD officers had given him with a copy of his police interrogation. Bodden pleaded guilty to 30 counts of burglary and remains in custody. This is a quote from the police spokesperson. "We appreciate people who leave this evidence for us. You get crooks sometimes who leave one thing behind. That's stupid. Both things? That's extraordinary." Couldn't have said it better myself. Andrew Bodden, you are an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0030. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff, again, is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding number for the program, and again, as I said, it's 0030. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. We hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com and World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.